Well, I'm taking the whole session for today to talk a bit more about learning. And maybe you will be wonder about why would learning be interesting for cognitive linguistics in kind of more general. Well, you know cognitive linguistics much better than I do. Yesterday, I mentioned that I'm just a poor psychologist. Formally, I was trained as an experimental psychologist, psycholinguist, because I was always interested in language. But learning theory was, since my undergrad, one of the most interesting fields or subdisciplines within psychology, intersecting psychology and biology. And I always had a great interest to understand learning and history, which I consider also to be one of the most productive and most resilient parts of psychology, taking as a whole. What was also interesting for me about thinking with this about this link between learning and cognitive linguistics, it's also peculiar that there is not much about learning in cognitive linguistics, despite the fact that usage-based linguistics, more generally, as a kind of more broad, as a broader framework than to which cognitive linguistics belongs, didn't look more carefully or in greater detail into learning, because learning would be actually the natural place to look for linguistic abstractions that are kind of emergent from use with different degrees of schematicity and other concepts that are typical and well known in usage-based and linguistics and even more so in cognitive linguistics. Because learning is what will actually naturally bring this, how these things actually emerge in the first place before they stabilize and become fully grown complex systems, such a language is. And I will start with the general quote that I kind of like very much. It's an old paper by Spratt and Spratt. Who claim that much like the law of gravity, law of learning is always in effect. And this is kind of shared agreement between biologists and psychologists who are studying learning, or at least who are using learning theory and learning framework to do their research. Of course, this is not a simple and kind of unified field, and we can think about the different perspectives about in to the problem of learning more generally. One principal position or extreme position would be a combinatorial approach or fully combinatorial. Another one would be discriminative. Perhaps the easiest way to understand this is if you think about cluster analysis. I don't know how familiar you are with cluster analysis, but to my best knowledge, many usage-based linguists and cognitive linguists, they do know and they use cluster analysis quite in quite sophisticated way. So there are two general approach to cluster analysis. One is called agglomerative, where you start with individual units and try to group them together to build groups and hierarchy of grouping. And another approach is divisive, where you start from one whole and then you break those into smaller bits until you arrive to individual units. So it's almost like, if you think more kind of generally, it's almost like thinking about trying to distinguish and to group things. You can either start by observing them very closely, you're close to this phenomena that you're trying to group, And then you see individual differences. But if you move back from them, you will start ignoring those details and then say, oh, those couple of units are very much alike. I will treat them as one, as a group. And then if you go further away, you will start grouping more and more until finally you're very far away and everything looks the same. So you have one big group of everything. That would be agglomerative grouping. So you're kind of moving away, starting to ignore minor and differences. And divisive would be you start from very far away, everything looks the same, and then you're approaching and start seeing differences between finer and finer differences until you arrive to more elemental units. This is also a distinction that is present in learning, where you basically the central claim would be what you learn is how to combine elemental units. And a different approach or another extreme would be to discriminate. So say everything is the same and I need to learn to discriminate what's important from what's irrelevant. So I'm starting to break things down. Going more into details about these two differences, so combinatorial approach assumes that most of the things in the world have their exclusive prints in our mind and brain. And this is very, it has a far-fetching implication for psychology and for psychologists, for researchers, if you think, because that assumes that we have all those units or their representations in our mind fully formed. Everything is already there. I just need to learn how to combine them in more complex combinations and in more abstract units, so to say. So for all of the disciplines, that the central problem, like for linguistics, for psychology, for statistical or machine learning, so for engineering more generally, is first I need to list them, and then second to describe a syntax if I'm a linguist, or association if I'm a psychologist, or combinatorics if I am statistician, so to say, roughly speaking, what's the syntax to what are allowed principles to combine them in more complex units, in more abstract units. On the other hand, discriminative approach claims everything is one and things get separated when I have need to separate them, when I need to distinguish them. And this goes back to early days of psychology to William James, who actually had a similar quote exactly saying, everything is a mess. I start to break things down to see more clearly only if and when I need that. So mental units in that sense emerge when, if needed, given a particular task. Perhaps, but I don't want to suggest anything to you, but it's worth thinking about which of the two extreme positions is more natural ally to cognitive and usage-based linguistics. Whether combinatorial or whether already everything is already given, all units are somehow magically existing, and then you just need to combine them to learn the syntax of how to combine them. And I'm using the term syntax in broader, more broadly than just implying linguistic business, so to say. It could be also psychological or mental business and even a statistical business, because statistics can also be understood in terms of what is the syntax of your model, so to say. Anyways, another thing that I like also to kind of discuss and point out is the history, how we started thinking about learning and how we positioned learning in historical perspective. So what are historical roots? Most of the history of learning is actually history of associative or combinatorial type of learning. And if we skip long ancient history, we can find bits and pieces in work of ancient philosophers about learning and how they thought about what that actually is. But things were more concrete, becoming more concrete and more interesting in about 17th century. Interestingly enough, that coincided with development of clock and all kinds of mechanical devices that were clock-like, like those automatons that were very popular at that given time on courts, and people were fascinating with machines that could play check, like Mechanical Turk and things like that. So that coincided with kind of general spirit of the time, zeitgeist. And people were starting considering, well, are we machines as well? Are humans and animals are just machines like clocks and other mechanical devices? First, a philosopher who actually very explicitly and in great detail discussed learning and this whether we are machines or not is René Descartes. And he considered that body is machine, but at the same time that there is some sort of a dualism that mind is free and godlike. And he was the first to describe reflex action, like animal spirits, stimuli, are traveling up the nerves, hitting the mind, the brain, and then trigger the muscle swirl down. So that's the reaction. At that time, so at his time, he already specified theoretically what reflex action should be. So you have some stimuli from the outside of an organism, from its environment, and that travels up from senses, it's being processed and sent down to muscles to do some reaction given that particular stimuli. But he was also convinced that mind rules. Mind is the boss, not the body. Well, Thomas Hobbes was the next to say, well, you know, mind does follow physical laws in the sense that we are all seeking, and animals, not just humans, we are seeking pleasure. We try to avoid pain and painful stimuli and so on and so forth. Even before Hobbes, Julien de la Mitte, in his book, Man, a Machine, was first to note that body affects the mind as well. When we have temperature, when we are in fever, and he went in great detail explaining all those situations in which body actually affects the way our mind works. So it's kind of a two-way street, not so, they were actually criticizing Descartes' position that mind, it rules the body so easily, so directly. Next one, and this when we look for philosophical roots, was John Locke, and he kind of proposed that we are born without any knowledge, so we are a clean slate or tabula rasa, and experiences in our interaction with the world is what shapes us as in development. And another thing that he was kind of very direct and insisting upon was that the world falls on us as a collection of very elementary impressions, and these atomistic impressions need to be combined to form complex ideas. If you think more carefully, basically only at his only in his philosophy, this atomism or combinatorial approach was pushed to extreme. Before that, it was less clear how we should approach to this problem. And this was one of the central points of criticism of all those who didn't believe that this is just a simple combination of elementary impressions and atomistic units into greater, more complex units. This goes very openly in psychology with the emergence of Gestalt theory, and they were openly saying, well, you know, the Gestalt is not just a kind of a simple sum of its parts. It's more than just that. And I think that's the problem that kind of lingers in theory of learning, many theoreticians and many empirical researchers were very much aware of that fact and try to kind of argue, try to position themselves and their work in that respect. Most of them were trying actually to avoid falling into this trap of vulgar atomism. David Hume was another one who was insisting on this association between elemental ideas, and he thought that this is the main principle of building complexity. And a contiguity between ideas in time and space is what makes complexity happen. There are also another type of, so these were philosophical roots. Then we can also think about biological roots, like those that are coming from Darwin's theory of evolution, which is a natural inspiration for all kinds of theories, all types of theories of learning with the broadest stand of theoreticians and empirical researchers in learning. Sechenov in Russian school was also one who was particularly influential thinking and talking and investigating reflexes in the brain. And he considered that mental processes can be analyzed as any other physiological mechanism. So he was very much into this. This can be broken down into simple principles and mechanisms, even the most complex mental activities. And again, more broadly speaking, a little bit of going back to philosophy, the time was again such that people believed in principle of parsimony, saying that if you can explain any particular phenomenon in simpler terms, you should stick with that rather than building in More complexity than necessary. One of the strong influences of that type was that people who did research on learning in animals, in particular like rats, dogs, cats, those were standardly used animals in some instances, monkeys as well. They would try to stay away as much as possible doing this kind of anthropocentric or anthropomorphistic interpretation, explaining animal behavior, like rats' behavior, in terms of a human potential. Like they didn't want to go into higher level processes and things. So everything needed to be very parsimonious. Another way of this, or let's say another famous expression of the same principle is Occam's razor. So you have Lloyd Morgan's law of parsimony or Occam's razor, which are essentially saying the same thing. Finally, we can move into more empirical waters. So apart from philosophical history and biological roots, we also have direct empirical roots. And the first and kind of almost like founding father of this type of research was Ivan Pavlov, who is coming from this Russian school of Sechenov and many others to follow both of them. And he first described classical conditioning as a psychic reflex. Almost at the same time, Thorndike was working in US, and he described instrumental conditioning and the law of effect. I will go into greater details to explain those two types, but I believe that you're very well familiar with both of them. I think on the one hand, for now, I can say that in classical conditioning, what is assumed to be associated are two stimuli. So you have something that is typically considered to be neutral, irrelevant, if you want, like light or mild sound, like bell or metronome or something like that, and one stimuli that is significant, biologically predetermined, like food. So you learn actually to associate that they will co-occur, that they will be, there will be a contingency between that light and or sound and food. So important thing. And then you, in the end, or animal, learn to start reacting on a neutral signal, which is then called a conditioned reaction. And in instrumental conditioning, you learn the effect of your actions. That's the simplest definition of what the animal learns. Thorndike used cats. Cat did all kinds of action, being frustrated just by observing food in front of the door, but the animal was blocked to actually grab it so directly. What it needed to do is to pull the lever, open the door, and then grab the piece of fish or ham or whatever Thorndike was putting in front of that door. So in the end, slowly and gradually, cat learned to press the lever immediately. And that is because that action, that particular specific action, like pulling a lever, brought a positive effect for the animal. You can also flip the coin and say, okay, it's the same way if animal learns how to avoid unpleasant situation like shock or some other unpleasant stimuli, it reacts, low effect drives behavior in such a way that I will in the end learn to do immediately something to avoid punishment, if you wish so. It is also interesting to mention in this context, Ebbinghaus, as a pioneer of experimental study of memory and remembering and forgetting, and he's famous for his forgetting curve, also because his experiments assume that learning preceded this process of forgetting. So it didn't happen out of nowhere. First I learned nonsensical syllables, then I started to forget them in time. And what he was measuring was that this kind of relationship between time passed and how much material I managed to retain. Next was birth of behaviorism, which kind of embraced learning as a central principle or central mechanism and psychological function to be researched, to be discussed and used in all kinds of scientific enterprises, so to say. And again, founding father of behaviorism was John Watson. He wrote a relatively short manifesto, Psychology as the Behaviorists Use It, at the beginning of 20th century. And after him, of course, I'm skipping some very, very important names, the names that I kind of even prefer, but for kind of general audience and in particular for this session, I think it's important to mention Skinner, who almost kind of reinvented learning do everything almost from scratch. And now he was using new terms instead of classical conditioning. He said this is a respondent conditioning because organism is more kind of passive. Those stimuli are falling on senses, and I'm just reacting on it without much freedom. So this is Pavlovian or classical type of conditioning. So I hear the bell, I see the food, and I cannot do anything about that. I just learn to associate them as they follow one another, and then in the end, I'm reacting on sound before food appears. And then operant conditioning also, he wanted to make a point that organism is more free to operate in its environment, to find the right response, to get this effect that the organism desires, to be more efficient, to be better adapted, if you wish. And in that sense, he was very clear about this. This behavior is lawfully related in principle to the environment. Tolman is one of my actual heroes. I mean, I also like Skinner very much. And I have problems to accept when people use the term that he was a radical behaviorist. I would agree that only in methodological sense, because he really insisted to have a fully descriptive theory of psychology or learning, if you want to be more precise. But he was not so radical in the topics of his research and in all kinds of ways. So he was more kind of methodologically very rigorous and uncompromising, if you wish. Tolman was very sophisticated, very interesting, and he made huge changes he made a great impact in psychology, among other things, and perhaps for us importantly, he started talking about intervening variables. Watson was very radical, and I actually think, but I will come back to this perhaps a bit later, that this Chomsky's vicious criticism of behaviorism in general, but then in particular of Skinner's book, Verbal Behavior, was actually targeting Watson. Watson was equally radical in psychology, saying this is just rubbish and we should just study observable behavior rather than anything else, rather than mental processes. They exist, but we don't know anything about that. We need external stimuli. We need observable reaction. That's it. What's going on in the organism? It's black box for us anyway. So Watson was actually the radical one. And I think that Chomsky reacted to that much more than to Skinner. But Tolman, in all this kind of complex picture and interaction between two disciplines, such as linguistics and psychology, to which I deeply believe that they should collaborate, and they have so much reasons and foundations to collaborate. Tolman was the first to bring back this internal variables of the organism states, hypothetical constructs that are not directly observable, but he didn't want to ignore this black box. He wanted to discuss, saying that actually it's not just stimulus and reaction, it's stimulus organism and that reaction. So he moved behaviorism in more mature, more developed phase, which is called neo-behaviorism. And in as much behaviorism was characterized with SR or SS type of relationship, neo-behaviorism was characterized by this SOR, which means stimuli organism reaction. Somewhat after the Second World War, there was another important impact to theory of learning more generally. And this is this brain to computer metaphor that was kind of parallel with the rise of computers in 50s and 60s. Computer can solve problems. We constantly solve all kinds of problems on a daily basis. So are we computers? Going back to philosophy of the 17th century, when people were thinking, are we just those mechanical machines and devices? Then here, it's the same idea that, oh, computers are solving problems. Are we just computers? And this was also parallel with the information theory of Shannon and other mathematicians, which is a formal account of how information is processed. Finally, in, let's say, beginning of 80s and onwards, for two decades or so, maybe a bit more, there was a huge and important subfield or area, which is which was developed on the idea of parallel distributed processing, or PDP, and neural networks, where we had authors like McClelland and many others, Plaut, and so on and so forth. But I will get back to this in greater details. So let's try to do a little bit of classification of learning, and then we will have a short break. Again, going back to this traditional distinction in biology and psychology, there is a classical Pavlovian conditioning, or respondent, as Skinner was terming it. And then you have instrumental conditioning, or operant, again, in Skinner's terms. And you know, this is just original picture. Pavlov is sitting here. This is Pavlov. This is poor dog that had this fissure implemented to collect the saliva. And classical conditioning is just a pairing of two stimuli. So there is a contingency of two stimuli, and then changes the responses to one of them. That's the very essence of the principle of classical conditioning, if you will. So you have conditioning stimuli. Initially, that elicits no particular response because it's irrelevant for organisms, some kind of mild sound or mild light, dim light. Then you have unconditioned stimuli, which automatically elicits response. Food triggers saliva. So the process starts the processing of the digestion. And then for this unconditional stimuli, you have unconditioned response. This is a response that is unconditioned. It just happens without any control. And finally, after pairing of conditioned and unconditioned stimuli, you can have conditioned response that is learned to be to the conditioned stimuli. So bell or light will trigger process of salivation. This is again Thorndike's box, and you see this was at the door, and cat that was inside needed to pull a lever to open the door and to grab the food. This is what he used to do his PhD. So an individual's response is followed by reinforcement or punishment. So reinforcement can be, it's more general term. So reinforcement can be both positive and negative. It can make the response stronger, or it can weaken or suppress it in principle. Event that increase the future probability of the response, we can use some kind of pseudo-mathematical or pseudo-probabilistic definition of what is going on, what is the principle of instrumental conditioning. Punishment, event is suppressed, the frequency of response decreases. So what are the learning principles of the two classical instrumentals? So I am kind of inclined that you have two subdivisions within learning theory. One that would claim that those are different principles of learning, and I would side in that division, which said, well, the principle is actually the same. You just need contingency. What is different in that in classical condition, you have a contingency of two stimuli. And in instrumental, you have a contingency of particular reaction and stimuli. So this is schematically, this is what is going on in classical conditioning. This is what is going on in instrumental conditioning. But you can say more generally, there is an ambient, even if you have reaction to stimuli contingency, there are many things that can also happen in parallel to it. Think about just a drug addiction. So you can say basically, strictly speaking, I am taking some drugs. This is my reaction, my reaction, and I associate it with pleasant feeling after taking particular drug. And that's drug effect. So you have this type of relationship between reaction, particular drug taking, and drug effect. But there are stimuli like room or door where I'm doing this drug taking, and these are happening in parallel. So I actually can have at the same time SS association while RS is happening. And I would stand firmly on the ground that those two are different because you have SS or RS pairing or contingency, but principle is just contingency more generally. So thinking about learning, we can also say something about different models of learning. And formal learning models, again, in biology and psychology, and machine learning as well. So one principle or one formal type of learning is error correction or error-driven learning. And this is famously defined in Riscorla and Wagner learning or Riscorla and Wagner rule. And then you have another type, which is attentional learning, of the authors such as McIntosh and Pearson Hall, who claim basically that what we learn, what is actually driving learning, is that we are learning to pay attention or to ignore cues like stimuli in case of this. Think about bell. We start to pay attention to bell or to light because it will signal food. And in error correction is that what drives learning is to find those cues that will minimize error in expecting or predicting food to happen. So my best predictor of food would be actually that light, because light is constantly preceding delivery of food. Finally, you have a third kind of type of learning. It's called comparator type learning models, and they are standing in a position of the other two, error correction and attentional learning, because those authors are calling attentional learning and error correction learning some sort of what you see is what you have type of learning, while comparator learning are also doing very much about absent cues, how we kind of adjust probabilities, not just of the light or the bell that I hear before food, but all other things that might happen in the background. They are not present in that given, but somehow affects my learning. So you have those two types. This is non-comprehensive and non-exhaustive scheme, so to say. And in computer science, typical distinction is between generative and discriminative learning, where generative learning actually, maybe it's easier to say discriminative learning is your typical statistical classifier. You have some groups and you want to find the best way to place new entity to those existing groups. That would be discrimination in principle. So you have defined groups, but in generative learning, you are not classifying, you're not grouping anything, you're just learning probabilities. And with those probabilities in the second step, you can actually do classification, but you are not doing classification in the initial step, in the phase of learning. So that's the difference. In discriminative, there is no intermediate step. You learn and you learn to classify and categorize. This is very natural for usage-based linguistic approach to all kinds of language phenomena, but generative learning types or family of generative learning would have this intermediate step. I'm just learning probabilities. I might use those probabilities to actually classify things. That's the very kind of easy way to think about this distinction. And finally, you have supervised and unsupervised learning. Again, supervised learning means you have groups pre-existing and you learn to associate belonging to a particular type or group, while in unsupervised, you're trying to group to find natural groups. It's I would say that cluster analysis, again, is a good way of thinking of unsupervised learning, because in hierarchical cluster analysis, you don't have predefined groups. You just try to group in some kind of natural, stable way, While supervised, that would be unsupervised. And supervised learning, you say, this is the right outcome. You somehow know what's the outcome, and you just learn to minimize the error of placing things in the right group. So think about having a material, having some corpus. One approach would be, okay, I just want to find some natural groups of things in this corpus of part of speech tags, like word types. But on the other hand, I will give my learning algorithm those categories in advance. So I will say this word is a noun, this is verb, this is, and then algorithm needs to learn to group in the to assign units and elements to those groups and find the to do that with minimal error. I think we have 45 minutes more or less, so I can stop here. Okay, so we are now going into, I'm trying to be funny a little bit. So this is a history part two, where drama happened. And this is what is my thinking about why learning is so peculiarly absent from cognitive linguistics and usage-based linguistics, and also to great part in psychology as well. So people kind of avoid in both disciplines, they avoid to talk too much about learning. So this is where the drama happened. And Dagmar and I spent a lot of time discussing these issues and why learning would be, again, in our opinion, productive way to do this interdisciplinary research approach. So, of course, Chomsky in 1959 came down with thunders to Skinner's book, Verbal Behavior. What was unfortunate in a longer run, but at the time, probably it was a wise decision made by Skinner. He found that Chomsky's review was very difficult to answer, and that Chomsky's tone was very emotionally charged. Many years later, you can find this traces of this silence by Chomsky and reasons behind the silence of Skinner. You might find something in Andersen's 1991 paper, where there is a quote that Chomsky simply does not understand what I'm talking about. That was Skinner's response. And to be honest, I did read Skinner's Verbal Behavior and Chomsky's criticism to it. My very generous estimate would be that Chomsky actually read maybe 50 to 70 first pages of that book and ignored the rest, and then came about his opinion and wrote this so emotionally. So basically learning was gone from eradicated from linguistics, but also in psychology. Chomsky was so influential that according to many, including me, I would say that he was very important for something that happened in psychology, which is called cognitive revolution. And I think that cognitive revolution was at least partly some sort of a olive branch offering to generativist, very strong, quite aggressive structuralist position and combinatorial approach. If you were a psychologist at that given time, so you were naturally a psycholinguist interested in, if you were a psychologist interested in language, you would be a psycholinguist. Chomsky did actually prescribe that you can only touch performance rather than competence. So there was a kind of strict division of who can do what in science. And maybe that's another reason why linguistics and psychology kind of worked in parallel, but not really communicated with one another, and why psychologists develop a habit just not to question linguistic abstractions whatsoever, but just to use them to test in the lab. So I would do some specific manipulation to show active and passive sentence, but I would never question whether active and passive sentences exist in the brain. That was given, and that was almost like a gospel truth. So what psychologists started to do after revolution, cognitive revolution happened, is just to try to do to combine boxes, to talk about memory, short-term memory, long-term memory. This is how they are connected. Then you have perceptual type of memory, like episodic, echoic visual memory, and so on and so forth, and how they interrelated with box and arrows. That was a pretty radical change in psychology as well. And as I said, this was very much in only performance if you want to do language. It's interesting also for me because I really like statistics and probability theory in particular, which is the foundation for statistics. Chomsky was he had very strong opinion about both. Learning has nothing interesting to say about language because that's for animals like rats. It's too mechanical, it's too simplistic, it has no saying at all. And also probability, he also said that there is nothing interesting in language. He acknowledged that there are frequencies and units in language on all levels of hierarchy do different frequency, but there is nothing interesting about that per se. So he just simply ignored everything that was fun. To be honest, everything that was interesting and fun for me personally, Chomsky said this is simply completely uninteresting. But then on the positive side, if you think about what Rescola and Wagner model, apart from giving some kind of pseudo mathematical formalization of what learning is, Rescola also gave a couple of really nice, subtle, insightful ideas about what learning actually means for organisms. And what he said is that what organism actually learns is the structure of its world, from exposure to relations among events in the environment. This is he moved away from this atomistic burden from the past in philosophy and later. And he said that, well, this guys, it's much more subtle than that. Basically, we do learn because in the end, when and if we learn, we are better fit to our environment. We are faster, we can run away because there is signal of danger or whatever. So we are just better fit to environment. So we learn structure of the world in which we live. But for language more specifically, re-emergence of some notion of learning back to language research was more than 40 years later after Chomsky's criticism. So Nick Ellis was the first to mention learning effects on L2 when we are kind of acquiring L2. Then a year after that, in 2007 and 2010, we have Ramsker and his collaborators talking about L1, early child acquisition of L1. And another important point, is the development of naive discrimination learning framework, which I did with Harold Bein and a few other collaborators in 2011. Actually, our work started in 2009, and then we got accepted paper with revisions in 2010, and finally paper appeared in 2011. But important thing in with this naive discrimination learning framework is that we actually facilitated scaling up being able to learn from large corpora to find a relationship and contingencies, significant systematic relationship between elements of different types and a different level in hierarchy in language from kind of naturalistic and large big data materials, like whole corpora could be learned with our system. And we will see more of it. I think on Monday I will show you a little bit more about what's going on behind the scenes, so to understand the principles of how this actually works. So why learning? Why? Well, it's probably my responsibility to justify why learning. Of course, as we mentioned previously, I think that this was just kind of serendipitous event that actually Harald Bein introduced Dagmar and myself in. I was already working in Tübingen. Dagmar was visiting Harald, but somehow Harald thought, oh, there are two people who are interested in Slavic languages more generally. And then he put us together to have meetings, and we started. That was the initial point when we started collaborating. And I always like to joke that Dagmar was a linguist that is very much interested in psychology, while I was a psychologist that was more than normal psychologist interested in linguistics. And somehow through our discussions, we figure out that learning is actually might be the answer or the centerpiece of our approach, or one of the most important ingredients, maybe not definitely the only one, but one that is quite central to our approach. And I would like to propose something, or to offer you something that is really well known in psychology. There is a famous psychologist and neuroscientist, David Marr, who had very influential book Vision published long ago, and it had many editions. He died quite young, and one of his main collaborators, Puccio, Italian by origin, he wrote foreclosure to the following edition in 2010. What Marr proposed is three level of analyzing and understanding any complex system. He was talking about vision, but this certainly applies to language as well. And then Poggio in this new edition or second, or even maybe even the third, but I think it's a second edition to Marr's book, he wrote nice words and say, he argued that Marr, David would agree that there is even fourth and fifth level when you want to discuss and research or understand any complex system. So what Marr originally said, there is the computation when we want to understand what and why is going on in complex system. Then you have an algorithm that specifies, or a function, how that takes place. And finally, you have implementation. Sometimes it's called wetware, but it's a neurological level. So how this is actually implemented in the brain. So if you think about computation and algorithm, that's very interesting. This is where I mean Dagmar and I agree that somehow linguistics and psychology speak to one another. So computation, what and why, is very much in heart of a linguist. What is the system? Let's describe in the greatest details why some things are occurring or not. And then algorithm is very much in kind of the central interest to psychologists to describe the function, the principles, the work, the mechanisms of that are driving the system. And what Poggio proposed is say the fourth level needs to be learned, how we learn to do this stuff. And on top of that is evolution of those learning machines, because those learning machines, such as our brain, didn't just happen, they evolved over a long period of time. But interestingly enough, Poggio said, understanding this complex system, and for us, this is language, at the level of learning is perfectly adequate as an explanation all by itself. This is what he wrote in 2012, following his foreclosure to David Marr's book. And now I would also like to cover a little bit this engineering strand. I hope that I kind of at least partly managed to convince you that there is a reason to, and there is some kind of interesting potential for and hope for learning and some sort of marriage between learning theory and linguistics, or involvement of learning theory in linguistics. But I would also like to show that there is a strong and very important, very healthy line of research that is coming from engineering, from, and particularly from artificial neural networks. The beginning was, again, as I said, in the 40s. One thing that you might know from as a kind of a general fact is all the work that Turing was doing to crack the code of Enigma machine of Nazi Germans. But at the same time, interestingly enough, and this is always what happens in science, that many people are actually working on very similar problems. So independently of his work, McCulloch and Pitts in 1943 actually hypothesized how neurons might work by relying on analogy to electrical circuits. And in 49, so just after the Second World War, have stipulated basic principles of association of neurons. So you have, again, association, which was discussed in if you look historical, if you look the past, in philosophy, and then in early days of research in biology and psychology. But then it's back again in engineering more specifically. But Hepp was, he worked across disciplines, I would say. He was neurologist essentially, but he was very important and still very influential for engineering and for the work on artificial neural networks. And then first application came about in the 60s, like Rosenblatt's work on perceptron, and then Vidrov and Hoff proposed a rule that was the first to be successfully applied to real life problems like signal filtering. Actually, their principles of learning were used in modern modems that we are not using anymore, but beginning of internet actually, and use of modems was somehow this filtering, because it was very noisy. Their principles of filtering out the signal from a lot of noise was based on Vidrov-Hoff rules and principles. In the same year, Kalman independently proposed a very similar but kind of a more general principle for signal filtering, which was again successfully applied this time in Apollo missions navigation. Nevertheless, after this initial excitement, this parallel distributed processing and artificial neural networks were kind of a little bit forgotten. There was a silence because there was a very strong criticism about limited value of this whole approach by Minsky and Papert. They did this kind of a mathematical formal criticism, and people were kind of discouraged to continue working on this. And then practically, if you think about computers, we are thinking about serial machines like von Neumann's, and this whole kind of parallel processing idea was forgotten, like, well, maybe it's not time, let's just forget about that. So there was kind of both practical reasons and theoretical criticism that made this less interesting at that given time. In 70s and 80s, this Vidrov-Hoff rule was kind of incidentally, almost independently, reinvented in psychology by Rescola-Wagner rule. So Rescola himself in 2008 said that basically his rule, or Rescola and Wagner rule, is essentially identical to Vidrov-Hoff learning rule. And in computer science, if you ever heard about self-organizing maps, Kohonen actually used the same principle of Vidrov-Hoff. And also, interestingly enough, Vidrov-Hoff or Delta rule is the main block, main building block of PDP networks of the Rummel Hart and McClellan type and later on. So this whole connection in Buddhism was also built of more complex architectures, which elements were actually simple Widderhof linear learners. Now, if we think about this architecture, and this is very much into spirit of engineers, let's draw some parallels between biological and artificial neuron. So this would be artificial neuron. You have certain elements, you have input units, and you have a signal of those input units, which is weighted by a specific weight. So this is input unit one, this is its signal, this is weight of that signal. That is transmitted to output unit Y. If we sum up this weighted input signals, then we have net or total input. And then sometimes, depending on a specific learning rule, this can be further converted into output signal or activation. I will tell you more about that, but this is very simple. So you have few basic elements of artificial neuron. You have input units, you have output unit. Input units are sending signal to output unit, but that signal is weighted. And this weight, just for now, I can tell you, but as I said, we will come back to that later. This weight will basically tell you how good this input is for this given output, whether it's predictive, like, is it a light or a bell? If it is, then give a strong weight. If it's something irrelevant, give a very low or zero weight to cancel this completely out. Now, this is biological neuron, and it has very similar base elements. So you have dendrites, which are our input units. Then we have cell body or soma, which is our output unit. And then biological neuron also sends its output signal out to neighboring neurons. So what is total input signal? So you have each input unit, it sends signal, it is weighted, or how valuable it is against some criteria. And we can combine this input signal and their weights to get the total input. This is actually the equation that is at the core of all those machine learning rules. So if we want to sum up, this is just a sum up. And this, if you look this in developed form, this looks very much like just a simple regression. In this case, this is a multiple regression because you have, this is your first predictor, the second predictor, the nth predictor, how many you have, and each predictor has its own weight. So these are those estimates or beta coefficients for against some criteria. Imagine that you have, again, some logistic regression problem. You could, let's say this is yes or no for against some linguistic abstraction. Is it present or absent? And then you have all kinds of characteristic from which you want to predict whether it is true or it's false, and you have given weight. So the principle is very similar to statistical regression. Again, the activation, so there is a difference between output signal or activation from your output unit, or, and it is always based on the total signal of your, so this is what is sent, sending out, what the unit is sending out, and this is what came from input units. And it is always said that this output is actually just a function of the total input signal. And what exactly that is, what function, it can be many different things. Simple cases, if your input is greater than zero, then output signal is one. If it is equal to zero or less than zero, then it's just zero. So you basically can transform your net input from input units, weighted input units, into something very simple. Either one, if it's greater than zero, or zero otherwise. Then you can complicate a little bit, which is called polar firing in engineering. If it is greater than zero, then one. If it is if it's exactly zero, then just keep zero. If it's below zero or lesser than zero, then it's minus one. And it's called polar firing in machine learning or engineering much generally. And then, of course, you can complicate even more if you wish so. What is the learning rule? Any learning rule is gradual. It assumes small changes in the weights of the associate and input signal with the output. This is the difference from regression. Regression happens in one step. You have all the data, you feed the data in, you get your prediction, that's it. In learning, assumption is, well, it's almost like incremental regression. You have first bit of data, you do your magic, you adjust your weights, you try to find the best prediction of your criterion. Then you have new data, you see whether that new data fits the previous experience, or you need to change those weights, and then you change them to minimize the error of prediction, and then so on. So data comes in, input data comes in small bits incrementally. You adjust your weights continuously, and that's actually the process of learning. Why small changes? Because learning is always gradual. It's very seldom that we can say learning happens at once. It is possible, and there are even empirical strong kind of evidence that can happen, but more than often, or typically, learning happens slowly and gradually. This is also because when I was thinking more generally about why it needs to be slow, why is that good? This is in my this is very, I'm sharing just my kind of personal thoughts. I would say this is because we also need to believe to our previous experience. Imagine that it's very rapid and radical, and it changes everything that we knew about particular thing in our environment, whatever that be. So that means that whatever I learned previously needs to be erased, and some kind of new setup needs to bring that. But we do want to believe to our previous experience. So that's why it needs to be incremental and gradual to keep accumulated knowledge, so to say. And this is somehow summarized in engineering or machine learning principle of minimal disturbance. It's very interesting. So if you think about learning from biological perspective or learning from psychological perspective, you see the convergence even with engineering approach. What engineers said is that in the light of new data, new input, the parameters of an adaptive system, so system that learns, should only be distributed in minimal fashion. Or Vidrov and Lehrer themselves, they say, reduce the output error for the current training pattern with minimal disturbance to responses already learned. So somehow what they learned previously needs to be acknowledged, needs to be alive and present. What about more specifically learning rules? So this is the change of those weights. So I need to weight my input signal depending on how useful for the outcome that is. This is the outcome, I use capital T, which is very common in machine learning, which refers to target or teacher. And I have a couple of things here, which is interesting. If you think, this is called learning rate. I want to learn slowly, so I put some small number here, and then learning is slow and gradual. What I learn is that whether my output is very different or a little bit different or no different from my target. If there is no difference, that's actually very good. So I'm on a good path. And finally, there is no learning if there is no input signal. So if this is zero and any input or cues are not present, because this is a product of three components, everything becomes zero and weights are not changed. You need new data to make that change happen. So learning rate, as I say, it ensures gradual learning and minimal disturbance. Outcome is teacher or target, T, and I'm comparing that with my prediction. And my prediction is based on input data and weights for that input data. Finally, I can transfer that into an output signal. This applies for perceptron, and that output can be different things. So as I said previously, it could be this polar firing. If it's greater, if it's net input is greater than the zero, make it one. If it's zero, keep it zero. If it's less than zero, turn it into minus one. So that can be my output activation. Biderhoff rule is even simpler, and this is the difference. So perceptron, Rosenblatt perceptron uses this transformation of net signal, while Biderhoff does not use even that. It's just a sum of weighted input signals. Now, this is very nice. I don't know whether you know about Dennis the Menace, and I think this is a beautiful cartoon showing actually how learning works, and the point that Riscola made, that we are learning about the structure of the world we are living in. So for dog and for cat, there is a signal that is very significant. They heard a can opener and they just ran because they were expecting, they were predicting food, if you wish. That was their target or the teacher. So cues are, or they need to be informative. The more informative, the stronger, the higher the weight is. Outcomes are important. Learning in its most simplest form, or most the simplest definition of learning would be there is some change. And hopefully it changes for better. So if we assume that learning is change, then that change can be, let's say, In its simplest form, it can have two forms. One is can opener, sun is present, food is present, animals are happy. The change is that weight becomes stronger. Weight, the change in weight signals that Q, which is the can opener sound, and outcome, which is the food, are kind of present at the same time. So the weight needs to be strengthened. It needs to reflect the good relationship. But it can also happen that can opener sound is present, but no food, because mother was opening, I don't know, can of beans or something else for making to make a lunch. So then they need to weaken the association between the cue, the can opener sound, and food. And then that is reflected in change of weight, which gets weakened. Of course, the problem is that you can have many other cues at the same time. Father can be a cue, mother can be a cue, just their presence, or kitchen, or Dennis in the kitchen, and so on and so forth. So what we try to learn, or what any system, be it machine or animal or human, tries to learn which cue is actually predictive of that given important outcome. So potentially and typically there are many irrelevant cues. Cues, they compete to take over the show, to be informative. And there is this change of weight between that cue that I'm trying to learn, the one that is really informative about relevant teacher, target, or outcome. So if we want to redefine what we discussed now, if Q is absent, as I said, even from definition, nothing happens. There is no new information. I cannot change anything. So it's weights are unchanged. They remain. So this change delta always expresses change in this case in weights. This delta is remains zero. If Q is present and outcome is present, this is a positive evidence. So I need to strengthen the connection. If Q is present but outcome is not, then I need to weaken the connection. And this is the this is the basis of learning. The learning rate is the same, and it's either I'm learning from the present outcome, which is indicated by one, or from the opposite outcome. And then I'm just basically calculating the difference, so to say, between yes, it's present, or no, it's not present, and the sum of all the total or the net input. And this is, again, the expression that it's used in machine learning. Again, what would be the common denominator of all types of learning that we discussed so far? One is that you have some stimulation, you have some data in the input, you have new information, and then there is some change. This is expressed by modulation of those weights, and then hopefully with better adaptation. Now, I'm finishing with this part, and it's very few slides remaining. So how is this relevant for language? Why is this relevant for language? Think about FERT. You shall know a word by the company it keeps. This is the principle of contingency. So you have word, but it is in contingency with many other words. And we can only know what's the meaning of that word by those contingent words. And this is also expressed in philosophy. The meaning of word is used in language by Wittgenstein, and even in psychology long ago by Vygotsky, who said word acquires its senses or its meaning from the context in which it appears. So this is the corpus, very simple sentence. And what we can say, okay, I can predict the word take from its context. Or I can predict context or other words from that particular target word take. And we actually use this in previous studies. This is just one study that you can look for. This is NDL form-to-form network. When I'm trying to learn about target word from its context and about context from the target word. But I can also go down and say, okay, I can learn or train another network, which is called graphene to form network. And we've been using that repeatedly, even recently in this year's paper, where I'm taking letter pairs or triplets in this case to predict how good cues, what are the weights for any given target word. And it's interesting also that these simple learning picks up prefixes, suffixes, all kinds of interesting stuff just by giving this kind of letter pairs or triplets. And as you can see, I kind of tried to mark that this TAK is a positive red cue. So it will take a positive weight. And these two are blue or cold or negative weights for this word, because this KE hashtag marks the end of the word also can exist in many other words. So for this particular word, it's not very good cue. It will not actually, it's not smart to use that to say, oh, it's a word take. Let me put it that way. Dagmar and I also tried to do something else. So we used behavioral profiles as cues to predict words. So this is from our paper in 2017. And if you want to learn about the details of it, you can check that paper. And this is the final part. I can link this whole story that I built for you with work of Ellis in 2006, this shared factors in learning L1 and L2. It's a contingency and one-way dependency, or delta P, that he was talking about when outcome is present and Q is present, and outcome is present and Q is not present. So it's very similar to the spirit of Rescoll-Wagner learning, and Ellis actually discusses that is what we could or we should use. Q competition is what he is also talking about, salience of cues, which goes back to this attentional learning models like McIntosh, Pearson, Hall, that I mentioned before in one of the previous slides. And there are also some other specific factors when we are talking about L2 learning, like interference, which can be retroactive, when basically new material kind of blocks and makes it difficult to keep on previously learned material, but you also have proactive, that the previously learned associations are basically making it difficult to learn new associations. And this is interesting. You can say that there is quite some amount of research in psycholinguistics and bilingualism, more specifically within psycholinguistics, on cognates. And this is one of the studies that I did previously with two of my colleagues, Maya Angel and Lori Feldman, and then Jelena Radanovic was my PhD student. And what we did, we compared cognates and non-K cognates in learning English as a second language when your first L1 is Serbian. And then Maya did a similar study or replicated study in Croatian and German bilingual. So two similar pairs of L1 and L2. One was South Slavic versus German, Serbian to English, or Croatian to German. But the pattern and effect is very similar. I will just skip these few slides because we're running out of time, unfortunately, and I will just try to wrap things up. This is what we are working on now, currently, and yesterday this question of context kind of popped up, and this was very interesting, and it's a great comment that learning, as I said, learning is always also contextualized. For language learning, context, like cultural context, seems to be of particular importance, and there is a paper under review in linguistics. Hopefully it will come out soon, and we are discussing this issues in greater details. There is another thing that I am kind of particularly interested from learning perspective, and to kind of use language to also help learning theory, to advance learning theory, use linguistic research. This is what I used to call fidelity of cues and their appearance. So we can talk about perfect and imperfect cues in terms of fidelity. You can have a cue that predicts, that is a perfect cue and predicts only one teacher, only one target, or only one outcome. But you can also have, and more than often you do have, a language that is so very present that actually one cue can be linked to many potential outcomes. And this is very kind of, this makes language particularly interesting to kind of think about learning issues more specifically. And then you can also have appearance of cues early or late, which is very much into Ellis's heart, thinking about the learning of or acquiring L1 versus learning L2. Generally speaking, and with this I would like to conclude, if cue and outcome systematicity is in any way reduced, so we have imperfect, we have late, we have some imbalance, learning is always affected, and in most fascinating ways. And that's very present in language. Thank you. I will stop sharing.